Today is Friday, the 23rd of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. COVID-19 cases continue to surge in the United States.
Unvaccinated people are at risk, and communities that are fully vaccinated are generally faring well.
Plus, protests erupt in Haiti as its former president is memorialized.
The protest started peacefully and unfortunately turned violent. And then they start to attack any car that looks official.
We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. has averaged more than 26,000 new COVID-19 cases per day over the past week, more than double the number it was just a month ago, with more of the contagious Delta variant making up over 80% of those cases. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedeker-Swore looks at the Biden administration's strategy for dealing with the surge as misinformation continues to drive anti-vaccination sentiments in certain groups.
COVID-19 restrictions on bars and nightclubs in some U.S. cities have been fully lifted, but the fast-spreading Delta variant has led to a surge in cases and hospitalizations, particularly in areas with high vaccine hesitancy rates. The Biden administration calls it a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is the director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Unvaccinated people are at risk, and communities that are fully vaccinated are generally faring well.
Despite the administration's efforts to push the free and readily available vaccines, government data shows only 49% of Americans are fully vaccinated. A recent Axios Ipsos poll shows 30% of American adults surveyed said they haven't gotten the vaccine. Chris Jackson is the head of polling at Ipsos.
There's a wide range of reasons given for not wanting to get the vaccine. And they generally speaking come down to some sort of sense of safety of the vaccine itself, along with not thinking that the coronavirus is that serious or that dangerous.
The data shows that anti-vaccine individuals primarily get their news from alternative media sources, which often spread health misinformation. Last week, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy warned of its dangers.
Misinformation has led people to resist wearing masks in high-risk settings. It's led them to turn down proven treatments and to choose not to get vaccinated.
A recent Washington Post ABC News poll showed 86% of Democrats have received at least one shot, compared with 45% of Republicans. Now the Republican Party leadership is urging supporters to get vaccinated. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
I want to encourage everybody to do that and to ignore all of these other voices that are giving demonstrably bad advice.
This marks a notable shift after months of Republican resistance against the Biden administration's pandemic efforts. Responding to VOA's question, Biden said he welcomes the shift.
I don't know how many of them believed what they were saying. They may have really believed it, but the things they've been saying. But I think once the realization occurred that this virus was only killing primarily those people who had not been vaccinated, I think it was sort of, as we Catholics say, a bit of an epiphany for them.
Meanwhile, at least two vaccinated White House staff have tested positive for COVID-19 after interacting with more than 50 Texas state representatives who visited the nation's capital last week. Patsy Wiedeker-Swore, VOA News.
Media and local physicians say that authorities in Myanmar have arrested several doctors for treating COVID-19 patients independently. Since the February 1st coup, the nation's pandemic response has been upended by consistent protests against the military junta that ousted Myanmar's civilian leadership, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Burmese activists say that several doctors have been arrested because of the prominent roles that they've played in the civil disobedience movement. Meanwhile, a new study says that two doses of a COVID-19 vaccine are effective against that highly contagious Delta variant of the disease. In a study that was published on Wednesday in the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers at Public Health England found that two doses of the Pfizer vaccine are 88% effective at preventing symptomatic disease caused by the Delta variant compared to 93% against the Alpha variant. The researchers also say that two doses of AstraZeneca vaccines are 67% effective against Delta, compared to 74% effective against the Alpha variant. A single dose of the Pfizer vaccine is just 36% effective against Delta, the researchers say, while one shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine was just 30% effective. A study posted online Tuesday suggests that the Johnson & Johnson one-shot COVID-19 vaccine may be less effective against the emerging variants of the coronavirus compared to either the two-dose Pfizer or the Moderna vaccines. The World Health Organization is urging African countries to ramp up preparations for COVID-19 vaccination rollouts in anticipation of the imminent arrival of millions of vaccine doses on the continent. Lisa Schlein has that part of the story.
New cases of COVID-19 in Africa have fallen slightly following 8 weeks of a fast-moving surge. The decline is attributed to a sharp drop in cases in South Africa. However, the World Health Organization reports the situation could change quickly as violent protests and mass gatherings in the country could trigger another rise in cases. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says Africa's third wave is not over. She notes 21 countries, three more than last week, are experiencing a resurgence. She says the highly contagious Delta variant has now been detected in 26 countries, and 13 of them need more oxygen due to a surge in cases. She says Africa continues to lag in COVID-19 vaccines, with just 20 million Africans, or 1.5% of the continent's population, fully vaccinated. But she says Africa's supply crunch is starting to ease. She says the first delivery of doses donated by the United States through the COVAX facility is arriving in Africa this week. And altogether, nearly 60 million doses from other sources are expected in the coming weeks.
African countries must go all out and speed up their vaccine rollouts by 5 to 6 times if they are to get all these doses into arms and fully vaccinate the most vulnerable 10% of their people by the end of September. Around 3.5 to 4 million doses are administered each week on the continent, but this needs to rise to 21 million doses each week at the very least to meet this goal.
Moeti says more than 500 million doses are expected through COVAX alone this year. This massive influx, she says, means countries must up their game.
We need to address the issue of vaccine hesitancy. So this communication targeting people, targeting the messages that we are tracking and the misinformation or the fears and misconceptions is absolutely vital now, because the time to mobilize people to be ready to be vaccinated is not when the vaccines are landing. It is now in this narrow period of a window that we have to do all of this.
Regional Director Moeti says countries must scale up their operations. She says countries need sufficient vaccine sites, storage facilities, adequate transport, plans for distribution, and of course, health workers to carry out this life-saving activity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China has rejected a World Health Organization plan for a second phase of an investigation into the origin of the coronavirus, which includes the hypothesis that it could have escaped from a Chinese laboratory. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson takes it from here.
On Thursday, Vice Minister of the National Health Commission, Zhang Yisheng, told reporters he was taken aback when he read the details.
To be honest, when I first saw the WHO's second phase of an investigation into the origin of the coronavirus, I was very surprised, because in this plan, the hypothesis of China violation of laboratory procedures causing virus leakage is one of the research priorities. In this aspect, I feel the plan disregards common sense and defies science.
The origin of the virus remains contested among experts. The first known cases emerged in Wuhan in December 2019. The virus was believed to have jumped to humans from animals being sold for food at a city market. A joint report in March by a WHO-led team that spent 4 weeks in and around Wuhan with Chinese researchers backed up that thesis. It said the laboratory leak theory was extremely unlikely. But other countries, including the US and some scientists, have not been satisfied with that conclusion. In May, President Joe Biden said U.S. intelligence agencies were pursuing rival theories potentially including the possibility of a laboratory accident in China. The lab in question is the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which have been conducting research on bats that carry coronavirus. One key part of the lab leak theory has centered on its decision to take offline its gene sequence and sample database in 2019. Zhang, along with other officials and Chinese experts at the news conference, urged WHO to expand origin tracing efforts beyond China to other countries. He accused the WHO of politicizing the study.
Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters News. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A mass was held in Haiti Thursday for the slain president, Jovenel Moïse. During that service, supporters of the late president interrupted and accused some of Haiti's elite of being responsible for his death. This comes as authorities are warning that there could be additional violence on the island ahead of his funeral on Friday. Handy Tiber joins us from Port-au-Prince. Handy, can you kind of walk us through what happened in Cap Haitien during the memorial service and elsewhere that really led to the violence there and what happened afterwards?
Normally, as we know, the memorial for President Moïse is set to happen in Cap Haitien. Cap Haitien is in the northern department of Haiti, the north side of the country, where the president is from, where his family is from, and everybody else. So that's why they choose Cap Haitien instead of the capital, Port-au-Prince. So the people there, since the beginning, since the day of the assassination, the people there, they were asking the most questions about what happened. They were claiming justice for him since the beginning. So what happened exactly is that as soon as the officials got there, like people from the government, to start planning the memorial, the funeral, anger, more and more anger was growing among the population over there, asking for one thing, asking for justice for President Moïse. So the first person who suffered the anger of the people was the chief of police. His car, his motorcade and his car was attacked by a group of protesters, and they accused him of negligence. They accused him of being part of the assassins of President Moïse, because as the chief of police, he is in charge of the president's security.
But there were also some wider spread protests throughout Cap Haitien.
There was a ceremony at the cathedral in Cap Haitien, and right after that ceremony, a large, very, very big protest started all across the city of Cap Haitien. The protest started peacefully and unfortunately turned violent. And then they start to attack any car that looks official, any car that have official license plate, like car from the government, car from the officials and stuff like that. They start to attack them, block road, and asking for justice for President Moïse.
Handy, this was the memorial service for President Moïse. The actual funeral itself is scheduled to take place on Friday, July 23rd. Can you kind of walk us through what we can expect?
And it's going to be a very private ceremony. It's not going to happen at the cathedral. It's not going to happen at the, any government building. It's going to happen at a private house owned by the father, the late father of the president. And that's exactly where he's going to be buried, next to his father at a private house. Something very important also to note is that the first lady, the first family, they announced that they will take care of all the charges of all the cost, all the charges of the funeral. They don't want any money from the country. They don't want any public money. They don't want any money from the taxpayers. They are going to pay for the funeral themselves. The family is going to handle the funeral.
There is one more thing I want to ask you about Friday, is that police and other authorities have also issued a word of caution about a potential for additional violence on Friday, the day of President Moïse's funeral. What can you tell us about what the concerns are?
Cap Haitien is known for being like a very active department. You know, any revolution in Haiti, any uprising in Haiti, start in Cap Haitien. Cap Haitien is like a crossroad for any uprising, any revolution in Haiti. So they know that the people in Cap Haitien, who normally you know, most of the time remain peaceful, but when they are angry and when they are protesting, it turns very, very violent. So that's why the police, the government, they issue warning about, you know, what could get down in Capetian during the funeral.
From Port-au-Prince, Haiti, reporter Handy Tebert. The United States says that it will not reconsider the type of training that it provides to foreign military members, despite finding that 7 of the 25 individuals arrested in the assassination of Haiti's president were one time trained by the U.S. As VOA first reported, U.S. defense officials said last week that the 7 members received U.S. military training both in the U.S. and in Colombia between 2001 and 2015 when they were part of the Colombian military. But Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said on Thursday there was nothing to tie that training to their alleged participation in the plot that killed Haitian President Jovenel Moïse earlier this month. U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters Thursday that the Democratic-led Select Committee to investigate the riot at the Capitol building will move forward without Republicans nominated by House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy.
It is my responsibility as Speaker of the House to make sure we get to the truth on this, and we will not let their antics stand in the way of that.
VOA's Catherine Gibson covers the Capitol for VOA, and she joins us to explain where things go from here.
Well, what's next is this whole battle over the members of the committee. You know, the resolution that set all of this up, that passed the U.S. House earlier this summer, gave Speaker Pelosi the ability to accept members of the committee who will serve in those hearings, who will hear the evidence, who will hear from the witnesses, and who can potentially request subpoenas for more evidence. She, of course, rejected 2 of the Republican committee members put forth by House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, and that sparked a real battle on Capitol Hill over the role those 2 members had had in rejecting the results of the 2020 election. Speaker Pelosi said today that those 2 members, you know, Jim Banks and Jim Jordan, were dangerous.
Speaking of Representative McCarthy, you know, he called what Pelosi did an abuse of power, called the whole committee a sham. What can the Republicans in the House actually do, or do we even have an idea of what they plan to do, since it looks like they aren't going to participate in this special select committee?
That's right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, Speaker Pelosi, of course, does have the power to reject those 2 Republican selections. So there's not a whole lot that McCarthy can do on that point. He can, of course, withdraw all of his selections and say that Republicans simply won't serve on the committee. He has a little bit of a wrinkle in that plan because, of course, Representative Liz Cheney, who is a Republican, has said that she will still serve on that committee. She has been eliminated from House Republican leadership for her comments criticizing former President Trump and what she calls the big lie about his election fraud claims. So there will be at least 1 Republican member on that committee, but it won't be one that Kevin McCarthy wants to serve on it.
Speaking of Liz Cheney, you know, she was appointed, as you mentioned, by, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, a Democrat, to serve on this committee. Has she mentioned anything? Has she given any remarks about this whole brouhaha between McCarthy and Pelosi?
She absolutely has. She was speaking to reporters outside of the Capitol earlier today and said that all of the events of January 6th absolutely need to be investigated, and that this whole tiff over who is serving on the committee should not prevent the important work of discovering what exactly happened that day when the Capitol and many of the top members of the U.S. government were put at direct risk.
Speaking of finding out what happened on January 6th, you mentioned that Pelosi is going to go ahead and move forward with starting this select committee as early as next week. What can we expect to see in the chambers of Congress as they get underway?
That's right. So we know that the first hearing for that select committee is currently scheduled to be held next Tuesday, July 27th. And we're going to be hearing from members of law enforcement about the events of that day. Now, remember, we have had very similar hearings up on Capitol Hill where we have heard some very emotional testimony from Capitol Police officers. We've seen some very disturbing video evidence played, and we can expect to see some similar issues brought up in that hearing, as well as possibly a little bit of back and forth between any, you know, Republicans who may eventually choose to serve on that committee and the witnesses.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. U.S. President Joe Biden assailed the Cuban government Thursday for its crackdown on freedom protesters and imposed sanctions on the head of the Cuban military and the Internal Security Division. The sanctions freeze any of the Cubans' assets under U.S. jurisdiction and prohibit travel to the United States. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also condemned the Cuban government's response to the protests that started July 11th. The United States has carried out about a half dozen airstrikes in support of Afghanistan forces during the past month. The targets of the attacks were mostly military equipment seized by the Taliban. A Pentagon official told VOA the efforts were to support Afghan forces and push back the Taliban. Without giving specifics, the official said that the strikes were part of the U.S. over-the-horizon capabilities. An official says that fighting in Ethiopia's Afar region has displaced 54,000 people. The leader of the Tigray People's Liberation Front told Reuters News that forces were there and planned to target forces in the Amhara region. In the capital, tens of thousands rallied on Thursday in support of the prime minister, who has been criticized for his handling of the conflict. An Iraqi delegation in Washington may reach an agreement with the Biden administration Friday on the withdrawal of American combat forces in Iraq. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the foreign minister said that he will meet with Secretary Blinken to discuss the nature of cooperation between his country and the U.S. forces after the agreement. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australian cybersecurity experts are calling for more aggressive government action to protect businesses from ransomware attacks. Phil Mercer is up next.
Big companies can be attractive targets for cyber criminals who can extort millions of dollars after stealing sensitive commercial information. The Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre is a collaboration between industry representatives, the Australian government, and academics. Its chief executive, Rachel Falk, believes Australia is an easy target for hackers because cyber defences can be weak.
More often than not, it's by sending an email where an employee clicks on the link. They get into that organisation, they have a good look around, and they work out what is valuable data here that we can encrypt, which means we lock it up and we'll take a copy of it, and then we'll encrypt all the valuable data in that organisation, and then we'll hold them to ransom for money. So it's a business model for criminals that earns them money.
The consequences for businesses can be extreme. They can lose valuable data or have it leaked or sold by cyber thieves. In some cases, hackers can disable an organization's entire operation. In March, a cyber attack disrupted broadcasts by Channel 9, one of Australia's most popular commercial television news networks. It sought help from the Australian Signals Directorate, a government intelligence agency. Researchers want the Australian government to require Australian companies to tell authorities when they're being targeted. They also want clarity on whether paying ransoms is legal. Experts have said Australian law doesn't make it clear whether giving money to hackers is a criminal offence. There's also a call for the government to use tax incentives to encourage Australian businesses to invest in cybersecurity. Last year, federal government agencies said China had been responsible for a series of cyber attacks on Australian institutions, including hospitals and state-owned companies. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The Tokyo 2020 Olympics are set to be the most inclusive games ever. with more than 160 openly lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer athletes due to participate. The inclusion has also put a spotlight on the host nation of Japan. Reuters reporter Soroya Ali has those details.
Gon Matsunaka is the founder of Japan's first LGBTQ center, Pride House.
I think lots of people in the world think that Japan is the human rights defender, but it's opposite, because we don't have any marriage equality. We don't have any law to ban discrimination on sexual orientation, gender identity. And also, we have the law for the transgender people, but they have to undergo the surgery to change their sex officially.
The Olympic Charter bans discrimination, and while Tokyo passed an anti-discrimination law 3 years ago, the same legal protections are not in place for much of the rest of the country. Rights activists hope to use the Games as an opportunity to raise awareness and public support for LGBTQ plus issues. Among them is Humino Sugiyama. The 39-year-old is a former fencer for the Japan national team and a transgender activist. He organizes the city's annual Pride March and became the first transgender person to be appointed to the Japanese Olympic Committee.
With the timing of the Olympics, diversity and harmony are the main concepts, and there is growing momentum for valuing diversity. So the public want progress with this issue, even within the Japanese Olympic Committee. However, there are not any members of the LGBTQ community who are able to talk openly about their sexuality, and that is why I was asked to participate in this project.
There had been calls for the Japanese government to pass an LGBTQ plus equality law ahead of the Games, but a bill was shelved in June after strong opposition among conservative lawmakers.
Reuters' Soroya Ali. With the Olympic Games opening ceremony scheduled to take place later on Friday, Olympic officials are warning against what they say are divisive political protests. But as VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the event may be the perfect opportunity for athlete activism.
Global Black Lives Matter protests. A Me Too movement in support of women's rights. Both sprung up in the years since the last Summer Olympics, and both may influence the Tokyo Games.
I think we have a perfect storm, if you will, for an outburst of athlete activism that is rooted in fighting for black freedom and also for human rights in general.
In the U.S., professional basketball players have been at the forefront of anti-racism protests. Many will now compete in Tokyo. U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe has also been outspoken for equal pay.
And I've been told that I don't deserve any more than less because I am a woman.
Olympic protests aren't new. The most iconic was the Black Power salute by U.S. athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the 1968 Games. The International Olympic Committee later introduced Rule 50, which bans player protests. The rule was loosened this year, but IOC chief Thomas Bach recently warned against what he called divisive protests, saying the podium and medal ceremonies are not meant for politics, which is ironic given that the IOC's own website praises Carlos and Smith as legends.
And they say what courage it took for them to do that. And I agree, it took a lot of courage. But they've made a new rule. Even these guidelines do not permit there to be a new John Carlos or Tommy Smith at the Tokyo Olympics.
Some conservatives in the U.S. say athletes should stick to sports, but the trend is in the other direction. The Olympics is no exception.
The Olympic Games and international sport is so entwined with politics, with all of the national symbols. It's the flags, it's the anthems, it's the emblems on the uniform, you know, the uniforms being in those national colors.
It's the biggest platform many players will ever have, and it's likely we'll be seeing what matters most to them. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.